We'd like to welcome you to this session of Sunstone, the Borderlands, Creating an LDS-Compatible Religious Model for Yourself. Our presenters are going to be Stephen Carter, and he is the editor of Sunstone, author of Mormonism for Beginners, and co-author of iPlates, a graphic novel series based on the Book of Mormon. We are also going to be privileged to hear from D. Jeff Burton, who is the author of For Those Who Wonder, and the long-running Braving the Borderlands column in Sunstone. He is a lifelong member of the church and has served in most local callings. We will have a question and comments period at the end, and so we would ask you to please keep your comments and questions till then, and please keep your comments and your questions at a minimum so that everybody can get what they want to say said. And we'll have you line up here and use this mic right here. Without further ado, here is Stephen Carter.
This microphone is made for short people, not for me. So I will hold it so you can hear me. And Mormonism for Beginners is on sale at Benchmark Books, right next door. Okay. This may freak you out a little bit. It certainly freaked me out when I first came across it. Unless you know about the sociology of knowledge, in which case this is going to be old hat. What we believe as individuals is largely dictated by the beliefs of the groups that we hang out with. We like to think that what we believe is the result of our smart brain, considering all the evidence and making an informed judgment. But it isn't true. To help you see what I'm trying to say, consider the Book of Mormon historicity debate. Looking out among all these intelligent faces and handsome ones, I'd say that 90% of the people in this room have probably had at least two different opinions about Book of Mormon historicity. Likely, most of you started out believing that its narrative is tied to real people who literally did the things that the Book of Mormon chronicles. That Mormon was a real guy, that Abish was a real girl, and that the Nephite and Lamanite civilizations actually lived somewhere in North or South America and would therefore have left traces of their civilization and DNA. Now, your belief may range anywhere from the belief that the Book of Mormon is a 19th century work of fiction by Joseph Smith to the belief that it was the product of automatic writing, or to the belief that it is a shamanistic text. Or you may still believe that it is a historical work, which is great. But how did you arrive at whatever belief you currently hold? The literature that constitutes the Book of Mormon historicity debate would likely take about half a lifetime to read. And then during that time, another half a lifetime worth of literature would have been produced. And the fact is, you can't process the full body of evidence rallied for or against particular views and theories of Book of Mormon historicity. Yet, you have an opinion on the matter that seems logical to you. In fact, it probably seems well-founded enough to you that when people bring up other views, you're kind of baffled and maybe even a little bit frustrated that they would be able to hold that particular opinion. So, to be clear, that you have your particular view on Book of Mormon historicity isn't a result of your having processed all the information. It is a result of your feeling that you have processed enough of the information. And then, unconsciously, you allowed your discourse community that you identify with to form the rest of your opinion. It kind of sounds like I'm slamming you, but I'm not. I'm the same way. The fact that you unconsciously rely on a discourse community, or another word for this that I actually like better but didn't write down, is plausibility structure. The fact that you unconsciously rely on a discourse community to develop your opinions, though disconcerting, isn't necessarily something to be ashamed of. It's just the way things are. There's simply too much information to process about everything. You're like a little camera walking through the world. Your lens is pointed in a particular direction, and you can only pay attention to a tiny piece of what's in front of you. And you can only be in one place at one time. And you pay attention to a tiny part of what's going on around you, only retaining a tiny part of what you perceive, only processing a tiny part of that, and only remembering a tiny part of that, and usually you remember it wrong. But you did make it here today, so good job. Let's see. Plus, there are billions of other little cameras, some of whom are in this room, walking around, and you have next to no access to what they've seen or experienced. So the world is quite simply too large for you to process. And it keeps getting larger. So, as a matter of necessity, you tap the discourse community you identify with to help you form your worldview and opinions. The LDS Church understands this dynamic well. Why else does it pour so much money into the seminary and institute programs, keeping students inside the Mormon discourse community while they're testing out the academic discourse community? It's also the reason why Mormons meet once a week for 3 hours, plus have family home evening, plus have youth nights, plus do home teaching, plus do visiting teaching, plus state conference, plus general conference, plus going to the temple. The list goes on. The constant contact is essential to keeping Mormons immersed in the discourse community. Of course, this tactic isn't confined just to the LDS Church. Think about your favorite talk show programs. Anything from Glenn Beck, what? to The Daily Show. All right, I know who I'm with. Often, the more content they release, the more devoted their followers are. One of the main reasons you have favorite podcasts is because they come out often enough to keep you engaged. They create a discourse community that is robust and recurrent enough to keep you to maintain your interest and your plausibility. So, one important thing to note. The ideas a discourse community believes are never completely logical or unified. Why, for example, does the conservative wing of American politics have so little interest in conserving resources in land? Why would they be so invested in guns? On the other hand, why are liberals so interested in preserving state-run institutions, while also championing people on the fringe of society? It's simply because those ideas happen to coalesce around that particular discourse community, and the logic tying them together was usually fitted retroactively and is therefore full of holes. This is the reason why the internet is always brimming with why what you believe about this particular issue is wrong articles, and with articles countering those articles. It's because discourse communities aren't 100% unified or logical. Especially since, yes, the world keeps on getting bigger and more complex. With this in mind, now that I've completely undone your entire worldview, with this in mind, let's consider why you have come to this session. It's called Borderlands. So when someone's in the Borderlands, that person is caught between two discourse communities. Perhaps between devotional history and academic history, perhaps a right-wing approach to Christianity and a left-wing approach, or perhaps you're caught between a democratic view of how the church should be governed and an oligarchic view. And when you find yourself between these two communities, you feel tension. Both of them are pulling at you. Now, if you're new to the Borderlands, this tension can be the worst thing you've ever experienced. A discourse community that you once held to be apostate is now starting to make sense to you. But your original discourse community was what gave meaning to your life. And you see all of that meaning slipping away if you move toward the new discourse community. You wonder what your marriage means, what your family means, what God means, what the church means, what anything means. So our first reaction when we come across this kind of tension, especially if it's new to us and it's stretching us between Orthodox church discourse and perhaps more heterodox, our first reaction is usually to try to escape this tension. Can you guys hear me back there? Am I loud enough? Okay. We consider just putting the issue on the shelf so that we can stick with the things we value about our original discourse community. Or we become outraged by what the new discourse community implies about our original discourse community that we want, and we want to just simply cut ties with our original discourse community and immediately go fully over to the other discourse community. Thinking back on your life and your own faith journey, you probably remember being in these particular places. You're like, I just want to leave it all. Why do I have to be with these people? Or you say, I don't want to go over there. That's too scary. I've been in both places myself. So, believe me, I empathize with these reactions. I felt both of them many times. I remember vividly how lost and horrified I was during the months of my deepest religious tension, and how I just longed to escape it, going one direction or the other. The tension was psychologically, emotionally, and spiritually painful. So in the back of your mind, you're probably annoyed with me right now. I've basically argued that the distress you feel as you consider your relationship to Mormonism is not the result of your commitment to use your brain, follow where the evidence leads, and be honest about the conclusions that arise from that evidence. Rather, it's because two discourse communities are fighting over you. And which direction you go won't depend so much on your integrity or your intelligence as much as how much time you spend with a particular discourse community. Is that annoying? Yes. Okay, good. We'll keep going then. Because you will tend to believe what the community you most interact with believes. Think, for example, of how much time you spend listening to podcasts like Mormon Stories and A Thoughtful Faith and reading blogs like Rational Faiths and Feminist Mormon Housewives compared to how much time you spend going to church. Which discourse community are you interacting with most? If you think about it, you'll see that the community you spend the most time with is the one that currently has the most influence over your worldview. It will always be that way. But this doesn't help at all, because the entire reason you're in the borderlands is because you're trying to figure out which community should have the most sway over your life, right? Which community has a more direct access to or a clearer view of the truth, which we always hope can be somewhat objective. Phooey, I just lost my place. If you think about it, you'll see, oh, I already said that, but I'm standing here telling you that your perception of the truth will be directed by which community you choose to spend your most of your time with. It's a tautology. This particular community is best because it influences my world most. There's no objective third party to help us evaluate the competing discourse communities. Anything that would claim to be such a third party would be just another discourse community. It seems that I have thrown you into a world without values. I've left you in a place where you have nothing to push against, where you can never find solid ground, and solid ground is precisely what you're looking for. I felt exactly the same way when I first read John Charles Duffy's article on this subject in the second issue of Sunstone that I edited, and from which I stole much of the preceding. The idea of discourse communities and their effect on our decision-making and worldview seemed very clear-eyed and useful to me. It freed me from the tyranny of thinking that I was right. It freed me from defending my view at all costs. It helped me to be more tolerant of other people's opinions. It also gave me humility and a willingness to be more open to information and the possibilities around me. But it also seemed to condemn me to living a life without a solid value base. However, I've had 8 years to think about what John Charles Duffy presented, and its implications about our discourse communities and how they affect us in the borderlands. And I've come up with a few ideas that I hope will be useful to you. A quote from Joseph Smith that Eugene England made popular said, "By proving contraries, truth is made manifest." Now, at first, we're tempted to think that proving contraries means to prove which of the contraries is correct. But England interpreted it to mean that we must go into the tension between the contraries. A good example of this is the early part of Joseph Smith's first vision story. Young Joseph is dwelling among many religions. Each of them is exerting its pull on him. He favors the Methodists, but he decides that he needs to do some more searching. In other words, he stays in the tension of the contraries. But what good does it do to stay in the tension between contraries? After all, it's uncomfortable, and sometimes even miserable, as we've all experienced. From my own experience, the good that it does is it makes us think and feel in ways that we wouldn't have otherwise. If a question is answered, we stop thinking about it. But if a question persists, we explore. Humans like to be comfortable, physically, psychologically, and emotionally, but comfort never leads to growth. For example, during the past 6 months, I've been going to both the Mormon Church and the Unitarian Church. And I admit that I enjoy going to the Unitarian Church. Is my bishop here? No. More than I enjoy going to the Mormon Church. Don't tell on me. It would be an easy decision for me to just go to the Unitarian Church on Sunday and forget about the Mormon Church altogether. It takes so much emotional and psychological energy to go to the Mormon Church each Sunday, while the Unitarian Church tends to replenish that same energy for me. But so far, I haven't done that. Why? It's because I'm starting to grow inside this tension. I'm drawing connections between these two communities. I'm starting to see how they inform each other and how they challenge each other. Here's another example. Consider how Sunday school classes often proceed. The normal approach is for the teacher to bring up a gospel principle and then ask the class to tell stories about how that principle is true, or to bring up reasons why it is correct. Now, it may make us feel good to uphold a principle we agree with. We do that here at Sunstone, too, in case you haven't noticed. But very little growth can occur in that kind of situation. This is why church classes and sermons are often so boring. They rarely dwell in the tension of the contraries. And even if the teacher brings up a contrary argument, we all know that it is inevitably a straw man that is meant to be taken down with ease. The most important thing that can come from a willingness to dwell inside of tension between discourse communities is the possibility of creation. Joseph Smith is a good example of this. He dwelt inside the tension among competing religions until he was called to build a brand new church, which turned out to be a very creative church indeed, complete with new scripture, new doctrines, new settlements, and a new marriage practice. Actually, marriage practices. We're often told the story of the first vision in church to reassure us that the Mormon church is God's true church. But for me, a more compelling interpretation is that the answer to Joseph Smith's prayer was to create something new. And he spent the rest of his life doing so, for good and for ill, as we discuss often in these halls. Think about the creative process. Whether it's art, literature, science, sports, religion, computers, or sales, new approaches and new schools of thought are created by people who are dwelling in the tension between current contraries. those who are comfortable in a particular discourse community don't explore, and therefore never create anything new. The thing is, the new thing that is created isn't necessarily the right thing or the correct thing. It is simply a new discourse community. And this new discourse community will start to create its own gravity that will interact with the gravities of the other discourse communities, making the possibilities among them more possibility-ridden. So now, even more new things can be made because there are more discourse communities to interact with. I think this goes well with the Mormon idea of how the creation occurred. We portray God as wading into matter unorganized and creating contraries, light and dark, land and sea, day and night, and then setting them into a productive tension with each other. The planets begin to spin on their axes and orbit the sun. The elements of the earth and the sun interact in such a way that they create the right environment for life. Lehi tells us that there must needs be opposition in all things, not so that we can call one good and one evil, but because they need to interact with each other. Otherwise, everything falls into a murky, undefined chaos. God called both the day and the night good. Perhaps this is the reason why God gives no answers when Job demands an interview with him. Instead of saying, as we often say in church, "Well, all that suffering was for your own good," or "I let evil happen in the world because of this and this," instead, God shows Job what God has created. And he asks, "So where were you when I did all these things?" Perhaps Job, like we often do, was trying to get God to be the objective third party, the solid ground to help him understand which discourse community was correct. He wanted to escape the tension of his questions, but God refuses to let him out. Instead, he calls Job to stay in the questions and create. "Look at what I made from the chaos," says God. "You're one of my children. Therefore, you're a creator too. Get to work." So what does this have to do with being in the borderlands? It seems to me that the tension you're experiencing is the perfect place to start your career as a creator. You've been released. I just released you. You may not have felt it. You've been released from the illusion that one discourse community or another has a corner on the truth. You don't need to choose between one or the other. Rather, you, with your utterly unique soul and experience, can welcome this tension and start to learn from it. Start to detect connections and challenges. Start to see what new thing is coalescing in this chaos. But as you create, don't take it too seriously. What you're making isn't the answer. It's not the perfect thing, but it is something that arose from your particular interaction with the world. Nobody else could have made this. I'm not trying to say that this is easy, though. Creation isn't full of dancing muses, secret gardens, and perfumed air. Creation is work. It requires that you abandon your ego. It requires connection to the people around you. It requires deep love. It requires failure. And it requires, as Thomas Edison said, work, work, work. So my current project as a Borderlands Mormon is to create a thoughtful, nourishing space in my Sunday school classroom, a place where we can drop our Mormon veneer and stop scrambling for faith-promoting stories or general authority quotes. I'm trying to make a place where we can talk about messy things in our personal lives, in the church, and in the world, where we can learn from these tensions, where even if we don't agree with each other, we still understand each other, which is my definition of being one in heart. You don't have to agree, but you can understand where each other are coming from. Creating this kind of environment takes hours of preparation before class, and it takes all kinds of energy during class. It requires, and this is really tough, that I let go of all of my hard-won theories that make me so happy when I think about them. Aren't I smart? Because I need to make room for my own class members to do their own exploring. And if my big old theory is hanging over their heads, they can't do that. It requires that I see the divine spark in each of my class members, even when they say things that seem destructive to me. After all, I'm just one small discourse community trying to interact with eight other discourse communities sitting in the same classroom with me. There's no possibility that I have a corner on the truth, and there's every possibility that I can learn and create from whatever situation presents itself. I thought I had one more page, but I don't, so that's the end of my presentation. Thanks, guys.
Well, you've heard from a creator, that's for sure. In my own case, I'm an engineer. We're trying to figure out solutions for things. But anyway, that was a great talk. I appreciate that. We're here today and to talk about, you know, what you can do with your religious life. In my Sunstone column, you know, Braving the Borderlands, I've defined a borderlander as somebody who stays with the church in some way. You know, whether you go to church or whether you pay tithing or whether you have a temple recommend or some way, you obey this word of wisdom, whatever it is, stay with your neighbors, whatever it is, you've figured out some way or you have some interest in staying with the church. But most of us who are in the borderlands don't fit the standard definition of the true believing Mormon. We've got doubts, or we somehow don't fit in, or maybe we're confronting an LGBT issue of some kind, or maybe we're having some other crisis of faith. Like one woman told me that she'd been passed over for being chosen as a Relief Society president, and that was an issue for her. In any event, we're trying to stay, and for good reasons. Usually, you know, one of the main ones is, you know, for our kids, for our spouse, because of my job. I've had people from BYU tell me about this, or to have fun, or to support friends, or just maybe some people like sitting quietly for 3 hours on those wooden benches. I don't know, you know, whatever. There's some reason. But today we're going to be talking about, I'm going to be talking about creating an LDS-compatible personal religion or a compatible way of life so that you could be in both discourse communities at the same time as Stephen has suggested we might look at. And, you know, I've got an example, a guy that I call Jack. I mean, I got a communication from him, and he was a closet doubter, but this could easily have come from somebody in the LGBT community, however does it, or, you know, any kind of other faith crisis that we go through. And anyway, here's what he wrote to me. Okay, I've decided to try to stay with the church despite my doubts, reservations, and concerns, but I'm torn up inside because I can't bring myself to do all things, as they say, to follow every church practice and procedure. I just don't feel that compatible anymore. How can I make this work for me and yet stay active and be acceptable? So, of course, we had, you know, a lot of discussions, but one of my answers to him was for someone to successfully stay active and be acceptable, it helps to create a suitable model for your living that's kind of your own personal religion, but make it compatible with the LDS model. And so, you know, he did that, and that turned out to be a good thing for him and for many others too. And when we do this, we have to carefully select the attitudes and the behaviors and the beliefs that will make us so that we can be compatible and also still be honest with ourselves. We have to be, you know, honesty is always an issue. Closet doubters are always confronting that. Another thing we have to work is find new motivators. What's going to motivate us to do these new things, but also stay with some of the older things? And so we have to look at the motivators, too. And what I'd like to do is explore with you some of these issues. You may have not have thought about it before, but you know the Mormon Church actually urges us to have a personal relationship with God. And they want us to have a personal religion. But, of course, in accordance with the LDS model. You've got to stay within their guidelines if you're going to have you know, basic attachment. And you know, that basic model is based on the foundations of Christ's mission and his teachings, like things like he was our Savior and all of his instructions to us on how to live and all the instructions we have on how to govern ourselves and so forth. And then, of course, the church adds a lot of policies and procedures that are kind of unique to Mormonism, and these are to be incorporated into our LDS personal religions. But in doing so, you know, there's lots of people who make it work for themselves. There's lots of people who are just perfectly happy with the LDS personal religion. And, for those people, great. But there are others like us, it hasn't worked exactly right for us. So anyway, do all of you have a copy of that handout? If you don't have a copy, raise your hand. Okay. Again, this is the engineering side of me coming out. If you look on handout number one, I've got handout number one on one side, handout number two on the other side. If you look at column three on handout number one, did you get a copy? Did you have a copy? Oh, you've got one right there. Okay, good. On column three, column three on handout number one can help you kind of identify what the standard or common foundations of the LDS personal religion are. These are my own impressions and how I interpret it. And, of course, you may see these differently, and you can write in. There's one line at the bottom, or you can change these if you want to or add more things to it. Column four is empty, and that's where you can develop your own compatible thoughts and attitudes and beliefs about things. And the last column I put in there so that you can kind of indicate your confidence in yourself. You know, I know this is the right thing. Or, well, maybe I better check this out. Or, I'm not sure of this one. You can kind of put something in that last column to give yourself some sense of confidence in what you're going to try. So look on the handout number one. Look at item number 16. Item number three of the Book of Mormon. I've written five of the church's standard approaches here, and again, you can find things on there that you could add or subtract from that. But take a look at that one on the Book of Mormon, number three. It's considered to be God's word and his work. It's a keystone of our religion. It contains the fullness of the gospel. It's the most correct scripture. And it's an ancient history of the Americas. That's taken straight off the LDS website. So, you know, that's probably pretty close. In my own case, I can go along with the possible validity or the potential validity of the first four. I'm not really sure. You know, maybe. But as for its historicity, I have real serious doubts. And so I have to leave that for some future determination. But in the meantime, this deviation from the standard model doesn't disqualify me from staying with the church. I can still stay in the way that I do. I'd have that as one of, and I can tell people about it. And, you know, people don't look at me like, well, you must be an idiot. You know, like, oh, yeah, well, okay. But if you look at item 16 now on personal life, look at number 16. The church would kind of have us be ourselves as being family-centered, church-centered, and of course we should obey all the things that we're supposed to. We should be Christ-like. We should be honest, kind, generous, and loving. And all of those things are in the what you would consider. I'm sure you can add things to it as to what the church thinks you should do with your personal life. But you'll notice that in many of these cases, that your view, if you, it will probably overlap what the church would have you do. For example, you know, most of us would like to make our life family-centered if we have a family. We'd all like to be honest. We'd like, most of us will pray. Most of us have faith in things that we don't really understand. And so, as such, the model that you develop for yourself, your beliefs, your behaviors, and your attitudes can be in concert with, but maybe different in some respects from the LDS one. There's nothing on this list, though, that would disqualify you from qualifying for a temple recommend, for example, if you want one, if that's part of your staying. And some people have told me, you know, this is impossible for me to do. I can't have a personal religion different than like that. I can't do that. And I think it is difficult for some, and yes, okay, fine. If it doesn't work for you, fine. But I think it's possible for lots of us because, one, the blessings of the gospel come through our behaviors and our attitudes, not necessarily whether or not we have a testimony in the divinity of Joseph Smith's scriptures. And a personal relationship with God is available for everybody. You don't have to be a Mormon to have a relationship with God. And prayer works for everybody too. And the church says that you can have beliefs that slightly differ from the standard model, just as long as you don't try to convert other people to your way of thinking. So we have to kind of look at what the cautions are. And you don't have to have, you know, a testimony in of the divine origin of the Book of Mormon to attend church, for example. You can do that. And emotional health, the last thing is, psychological studies have shown that our emotional health is easier to maintain when our actions and our behaviors and our attitudes actually follow along with our true beliefs and feelings. And that's easier to do if you have your own personal religion. Now, look at handout number 2. Flip the page over. This is an example of a personal religious model. It's kind of modeled on mine. Yours may be like this, but of course it'll be unique to your own needs. I suggest that you start off by writing out a draft and then change it. You know, make it a draft and practice with it and then change it as you need to. Don't think that you're failing if you have to change something. I think it's important to put these things in writing. Don't just put it in your mind because you'll forget or you'll get it confused. Actually write it down. That's always helped me and others too. Let's look at how this model was constructed. You can see that in this particular case, I've divided this model into 6 major sections. You might have more sections or less sections. These are ones that were important to me. If you're employed by the church, for example, you might have a section that says, you know, as it pertains to my job or to my coworkers down at the church office building, so that, you know, you'll have a unique set of things that I don't have to deal with and others don't have to deal with. In each section, I've stated what I believe or what I'm willing to accept on faith or how I want to behave or what attitudes I want to project to people and the things that I need to do to make my personal religion work for me. Keep in mind that, you know, each of these statements is like a goal. If I could be perfectly follow each one of those, I'd probably be translated someplace. But these are goals for us to try to achieve. And we learn how to do it as time goes by. Now, there's a few risks with this personal religion thing. Some people may not like it. Your spouse might not like it. So there's 3 risks that I've kind of identified that are kind of unique. What if your family decides to follow your members, your example, and come up with their own personal religion? What if your kids decide, okay, you're going to do it, I'm going to do it too? Well, you're going to have to be willing to go along with it and help them and, you know, work with them on that. There may be some people in your ward or some local leaders who will disapprove and may distance themselves from you. And, what do you mean you're going to drink a cup of coffee occasionally? Yes, I think it's good for my health. My grandmother, 90 years old, asked me, do you think it'd be okay if I had a it's just a tiny cup of tea. It helps me to sleep or something. I said, I think at your age you'll be fine. Don't worry about it. But so there are people who will be concerned. And also this new approach, you know, you got to bring it on people kind of slowly. If you bring it on too suddenly, you can upset the apple cart. And so proceed cautiously and be ready to make changes. If, you know, if it isn't working for your spouse, then you need to sit down and talk to him or her and say, well, what can I do to make it work so that we can both live off this? Now, I've found for myself even that living my model was difficult at first. You'll find it a little difficult. But don't be afraid to back off and change your model to be more realistic and workable for you and others around you. And I've noticed also that people come up with models that are more stringent than the church's model. They often come up with things that are too stringent even for themselves to try to live with. And so you have to give yourself patience, be patient with yourself, with yourself, and don't overdo it. Be willing to change it and lighten up a little bit if you need to. Look at handout number one again. Flip over to item 14. This is another issue we have as motivation. If you look at number 14, the standard motivations, you know, there's both the presenting motivations and the hidden motivations. The presenting ones are the ones we always like to say, you know, we'll be rewarded with a life in the celestial kingdom if we follow and so forth, all the things that are great. If you pay your tithing, you'll be reimbursed tenfold and all these kind of promises and rewards and things. Those are the presenting ones. Then there's the hidden ones, like fear, guilt, hope, and then there's others. You know, guilt is a very powerful motivation. If you're feeling guilty about taking a sip of tea, then you know it can have quite an impact on your life. So you have to kind of be aware of what your motivations are. Sometimes a great motivator in the church is, you know, living a certain lifestyle so that we can qualify for a temple recommend. There's also the group pressure or the community, you know, the discourse community. You know, they're putting pressure on us. Hey, what do you mean you don't believe the way I do? So we have to be kind of careful and analyze and think about what these motivators are. Love is a motivator. Punishment can be the idea that I'll be punished if I don't pay my tithing. And there, you know, the divine pleasure, divine displeasure, one of those two things can be quite big motivators. So if you have your own personal, you know, that's the standard model. Those are the motivators, a lot of them, for the standard LDS model. If you have your own, personal relationship, some of these motivators may not work. And you'll have to come up with some new motivators in some cases to stay with some of the older things we want to keep doing and also to do the new things that we want to do for ourselves. They'll have to be, you know, you'll have to watch out and look for other motives. I lost my place here. Rewards can continue to be a motivator, of course, but hopefully they're going to be rewards of things like, you know, simple goodness or of doing well or succeeding or seeing your children happy. Those can be real effective motivators if you allow them to be that. And of course the group pressures, they're going to be involved there, but the groups might be a different group. Those discourse communities can change, as Stephen said, and you know, maybe they go from your ward group to maybe to a group of friends or Mormon friends or to non-Mormon friends or somebody outside that particular group. You want to identify and kind of decide which group is going to have more of an influence on you, and be ready to change if you need to. One good thing, we like to think of ourselves as being realistic and reality-based, and now these can be motivators. They comfort us. You know, we think we're doing the real thing. If we're following reality and we're using reason, they comfort us because it makes our decisions seem like they're the right decisions. They're based on facts and data and so forth. That's the engineering side coming out again. Sorry. honesty, it could be a motivator. There's a real good feeling if you know within your heart that you're being honest with yourself and with others. So that's a good motivator. But whatever will motivate you, and this is going to take time, write those down in the fourth column of handout number two, or handout number one. And you can use handout number one then to help you to develop handout number two, your personal religion. If you want more information, you could go to my Borderland columns. For example, column number 18 cover this very topic. If you go to my website, it's got the same name as my book, For Those Who Wonder. It's forthosewhowonder.com. You can download my book for free if you want to, at a PDF version. And over in the bookstore, they've got some copies over there if you want to buy one. But you can download it for free from that website. And also, all the Borderland columns, there's been about 55 of those now. We 55 or 56, right? All of those columns are there. So if you want to go and see some of those Borderland columns, you're welcome to go. That's forthosewhowonder.com. To wrap up, I want to give you a little time to be able to talk. But, getting a new model for your life, it can be a challenge. But it can be quite rewarding if as you succeed. We've talked or heard about stages of faith. James Fowler, in his famous book, he had six stages of faith. And where we, most of us in the borderline, find ourselves is in stage four. That's the one where you have lots of doubting and tension and problems and frustrations and so forth. We're not, stage three is, the true believer group, the in group, those that go to church and don't have any questions. That's three. And James Fowler says is that if you're in stage four and you want to move on, you can always go back to stage three. And what we're trying to do is at least leave if you're having a personal religion that's compatible, we're keeping one foot back in, or part of ourselves back in stage three. It's where it's comfortable and nice and it's our friends are there and our family and so forth. But you can also move on to the blessings of stage five, which is James Fowler talks about: having peace of mind, acceptance, universalizing love, a personal relationship with God, and following your own personal religion. So what we're talking about here is moving on toward stage five. If you come up with something that's compatible, you can be in three, four, and five and be comfortable, perfectly comfortable with it all. Anyway, that's my presentation for today. I'll turn our time back to our moderator now, and we'll have some questions and comments.
This is... Oh, it's not on. Can you hear me? This has truly been a wonderful presentation, in my opinion. Anyone who has comments or questions, please come up here so you can use the mic, because they're recording everything. They want to record the whole session.
Sending it to the church office building.
Oh. To your wards and church offices. Can you hear me in the back, okay? Would you like to come up?
You have to stand up.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Phyllis Rucker from Dallas. And I had an experience with my dad on his deathbed that I wanted to talk to someone about, and I think this is the right group, I hope. My dad's 90, and I was with him on his deathbed, and he said, "Daughter, you need to repent." And I said, "Well, Daddy, what is it that you don't like about my life?" And he said, "I love everything about you and everything that you say and do." And I said, "Well, then of what do I need to repent?" And he said, "You need to go to church." And I said, "But Daddy, when I get up in the morning and look at myself in the mirror, I can't be proud and be a Mormon." And he let out this huge sigh. He's a big man. He let out a huge sigh, and he said, Well, I never said I believed it. I mean, he'd only been a bishop, a high councilman, held all these jobs. And he said, I never said I believed it. I just wanted to unify my family. I mean, I was totally blown away. But you know, see, I'm honest with myself, and I'm so happy. And to think that he went through life doing that. Of course, he got a lot out of it. He did a lot of service, had a lot of respect in the community and everything. But he was living a lie.
Thank you. Anyone else? Please come up here if you have them. And I know it's kind of a little bit putting everyone on the spot to line up, but please do so.
Well, I want your comments, too, and your answer or comment to hers. Mine is, and I'm an active Mormon, and all of my husband is, too, super believer, and but questions himself. But my temple recommend expires this month, and all my family are active, my children and my grandchildren, and so I want to keep a temple recommend. But I have more questions now than I have before. So I'm not sure how to address all those answers to the temple recommend. I went to the temple yesterday, and my husband did too, and he always comes out inspired and happy, which is wonderful. And I always come out thinking, I hate veiling my face. Why don't they ever have people of color in those movies? And I'm still, the reason I'm here this time is I'm struggling with the policy on the children of gay parents. And the fact that we got three new apostles who are all white Utah millionaires. And so I'm questioning my prophet. So I would like to hear how you deal with the temple recommend thing.
I'll go first, and Stephen can make comments too. You know, this is a very common problem.
I want to go to all my kids and grandkids' weddings.
This is a very common problem, and you know, I've been a branch president. I've been involved. I've been to two bishoprics, and I've been in all kinds of temple recommend interviews and so forth. And I've had a temple recommend myself plenty of times. I mean, I don't have one now, but I get one when I need one. And you know, if I want to go to a wedding or I want to take a mission, I go get one. And most bishops have heard all of the people say, well, you know, if I don't know if I can really say that. All you have to do is say, I will accept it on faith. Most bishops will accept that comment. I don't know if the prophet's a prophet, but I'll accept it on the possibility it is and on faith. I'll take it on faith. They're looking to give you the recommend, trust me. And you'll find a way. And if your husband's been a bishop? Oh, okay. Well, and if you want to, you know, talk to people who have been through this. There are lots of people here who have. So I think you could do it. And it'd be perfectly fine. So.
And another way to think about it is when he says, like, do you accept Thomas S. Monson as a prophet and things like that? You remember when Abraham was running towards Sodom and Gomorrah and he was bargaining with God and he was whittling God down for how few people could. So prophets are quite frequently in tension with God. And to me, the best way to be a sustainer of a prophet or of a leader is to be in a creative tension with them. And if you're just doing everything that they say in the way that you think that they absolutely want it to do, you're not in a creative tension with them, and you're not the productive servant that God asks us to be. You're the slothful servant. Whereas if you bring your entire self and your creativity to the encounter, then they won't always get what they want out of you. when I was called to be the Sunday school president, it took about 2 weeks for me to get the whole presidency together because I insisted that I needed a female counselor. And I fought with a branch president for about 2 weeks on that. And eventually he won, but it helped. because then he knew who I was, and we have continued in this sort of tension-laden relationship. And I sustain him the way I sustain. So, you know, you can always keep that in the back of your head. Yes, I sustain in a tension-ridden way.
I should probably make one more comment to you, and that is you do have to be following the rules. You have to be paying tithing. You have to be obeying the word of wisdom and stuff. I mean, you don't really do any lying, but it's those other issues that are the gray areas. You could be gray. It'll be okay.
Okay, so that just answered my question. Because on your paper, it says, you know, I follow the word of wisdom on occasion except for a treat here and there, and then I make regular donations with modification, and So you probably are, you know, under the radar, and you probably be able to get a recommend very easily. Where I'm not as under the radar so much. I don't wear my garments. I drink tea and currently off giving my 10% to other organizations. So I don't see how I'm going to be able to fall in that category where it says I qualify. It's because I don't qualify for the temple recommend necessary to attend weddings. I come from a family of non-LDS, so it's going to be fine for my family, but not for my husband's family. They're Mormon back to the beginning. They have all the pioneer stock. I am so scared for how this is going to come down on my husband, and I'm a convert. I am so worried that I don't know what I'm going to do, because we have 19 grandchildren on my husband's side of the family, and they're like 21, 22, 23, you know, 20, 19, 18, 17. They're all going to be getting married, like bam, 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 and I don't know what I'm going to do, and I don't know how to handle it. I guess I put my garments back on, I pay my tithing, I do the things I don't want to do so that I can show up, so that it doesn't hurt my husband. That's my question. I don't know.
I appreciate you bringing this to the tension-ridden place. I understand a little bit of what you went through, because my sister got married and half the family couldn't be there. Half the family was in the temple room and half the family was at the Blue Lemon. And you're right about that. It was a hard thing, but we did something really interesting. How much time do we have left?
2 minutes.
2 minutes? Oh, and you were the last person. It will take work, and it will take a lot of talk with your husband and with your children. See, to me, the most important thing that happens between families at sacred moments is that they connect. And that can be done anywhere, but you have to put the work in first. A lot of times I feel like we go into the temple or we go into the church and we say, the fact that we're here and the fact that we know what the ritual is and that there's so much precedent, that will automatically give us the connection that we need. And it doesn't always happen. When my sister got married, we actually put together a little ritual of our own that we had before the temple ceremony so that everybody could be there. And if you want to stop by afterward, I'd be happy to tell you about it. And it really helped, because then everybody could be there, and we were connecting with each other because we were a family, not because we were Mormon. But to me, that is Mormonism. Mormonism says family first. And if that is coming from you, you are my family, and I'm going to do everything to connect with you as a family. You will create something new and beautiful. Or are we done? Okay. But yeah, you can come talk to me afterward. Thanks for coming, everybody.